Hello and welcome to Spirit of Truth Church for this talk on Christianity and anti-Semitism, where we examine anti-Semitism throughout church history. Now, this is going to be kind of a lot of an overview. We are going to try to cover about 2,000 years of church history, so we're going to be kind of picking out small aspects of this. But what we really want to do is to present a record of this conflict between Judaism and Christianity throughout church history. And we want to also look at what was being taught. We want to look at the underlying theology and the underlying eschatology here. Now, here's the issue that you're going to see, I believe, as we kind of proceed through this, is that what's going to happen is that this doctrine of supersessionism, or the idea that the church has replaced Israel, is going to sort of be the root of a lot of anti-Semitism. And I would argue that the goal of all Christian doctrine should be godly living. It should be holiness. It should be God-honoring life. Okay, that should be the actual fruit of good theology. So as we take a look at Israel and Christianity throughout the centuries and look at the Christian anti-Semitism or anti-Judaism that's occurred, I also want to say this. Just because someone's been anti-Semitic doesn't mean that everything they've said is incorrect or wrong. What's one of the hardest things, I think, for people to realize is when they have favorite theologians and they come to find out that these theologians, you know, participated in various forms of persecution against other Christians, or they participated in anti-Semitism, or a variety of other things. But in other words, they weren't perfect, and in fact, in some cases, they seem to be very wrong. And we have to understand that all of this occurs in history. This all occurs in a context and a time. And so we can't necessarily judge people by our modern standards as to how they act and behave back then, even though we can disagree with their actions and we can say that they're morally wrong and evil in some cases. But we also have to understand that people exist in the time periods they exist in. So with that, I also want to say I'm still struggling a little bit with, and I'm going to be having my water bottle here, still struggling a little bit with bronchitis and some other things. So I'm going to be trying to drink a decent amount throughout this talk. But, you know, hopefully things will be fine. So let's go ahead and jump right in then to the early church to 135. So the problem with the first, you know, sort of 135 years is that you essentially have the opposite happening. You actually have fairly heavy-handed persecution of the church by the Jerusalem leadership and by the Israeli leadership at that time. And so the Jerusalem Jews were very much against the Christians at that point. But again, these are also Jewish Christians for the most part. And this dissension continued to grow. And there was even a dissension as well between the Gentile and Jewish converts to Christianity. And so you're seeing all of this stuff sort of fester. Because remember, the Jewish leadership had just put Jesus to death, and now Christianity had basically burst on the scene. There was persecutions. These are recorded in the book of Acts. I mean, it's very clear what's been going on. Saul had done his persecutions, then converted. So there was a lot of anti-Christian stuff coming out at the very beginning. But again, it was almost Jewish on Jewish kind of stuff. In other words, it was the beginning of the church was mainly formed of Jews. There were Gentiles as well, but the Jewish leadership then attacked Christian Jews. And they attacked everybody, but Christian Jews especially, given the region they were in. So this is going to cause some problems even within the church. It's going to cause some problems between Jerusalem church and other churches that are more Gentile churches until Peter kind of gets this revelation from God that Gentile Christians don't have to submit to Jewish customs. Okay, and that actually helps things for a time. Also, with the destruction of the temple in 70 AD, this is another big issue where essentially Christians kind of fled Jerusalem earlier, and then the Jewish Jews, or the Judaistic Jews, stayed, and they're the ones that took the brunt of the persecution by Rome and of the attack from Rome. And so that kind of caused another rift as well. And so you have these unfortunate early rifts begin, and they never really truly healed. Now, by 135, the church in Jerusalem was no longer revered. Again, Jerusalem had been sacked and destroyed. You had the Bar Kokhba revolt. You had all these different things go on. And Antioch, a Gentile church, was thriving. You also had the destruction of the temple, which fed into anti-Jewish sentiment. And you had, again, the messianic claims of Bar Kokhba, where nearly 600,000 Jews were killed. Many were sent into the diaspora. The temple was basically renamed the Temple of Jupiter, and they renamed the city and the region. In other words, Israel as we know it was essentially dissolved for the most part, and people were dispersed. And so the church in Jerusalem, specifically the Jewish, most Jewish church, became associated with the defeated Israel. And that's another big piece of theological interpretation that came along with this. And unfortunately, this resulted in anti-Judaism becoming very normative. Now, this then bleeds into the patristic period. So the Gentiles began to understand themselves as grafted into the blessings of the Abrahamic covenant. That was the original understanding. The original understanding was that they are grafted in. Okay. Now, however, during the patristic period, you start to see the church being asserted as superseding Israel, as the new spiritual Israel. Okay? You're going to start to see the church being read back into the entirety of the Old Testament history. And people are going to start talking about how Christian history is shown to be older than Jewish history in that it dated from creation. And you see this even today in Reformed discussions on this, where essentially it's actually Christianity that really is the through line throughout all of human history, not the covenants as stated in Scripture, or Judaism and Christianity. In 160 AD, Justin... Sorry, I still do have a couple coughs. In 160 AD, Justin Martyr, in his dialogue with Trypho, this is the first time that the church was plainly described as the new spiritual Israel and the new custodian of Scripture. Because remember, the Jewish people were the custodians of Scripture up until this point. So from the patristic period, we move into the pre-Constantinian era. So again, you're starting to see at this point the church becoming a little bit more formalized. You're getting sort of the bishoprics and things like that, where you're getting these church institutions in various areas and regions, and they kind of have ownership of those regions. And it's interesting because even though the status of Jewish Christianity was receding, Judaizing groups are still a problem. So you still have people like the Elkosites, the Ebionites, who we talked about in a previous lecture, Corinthians for a time as well. There were radical conservative groups of Jewish Christians, okay? And this Judaizing that did occur in some of these groups really started to become under a concern for people who were writing for the true doctrines of grace. And they began, especially some of the main church fathers, began to write serious books and tracts and things like that against some of these theologies. Unfortunately, there's an association of the theologies with the people. And so again, you have Jewish Christians essentially being put down. And so you have Tertullian, who said that Jewish people were essentially an anti-type of true virtue and embodied the principle of obsolescence. Interesting. You have Irenaeus of Lyon saying that Jews had been disinherited from the grace of God. Hippolytus of Rome saying Jewish exile and judgment would not be limited to 430 years of servitude in Egypt, but would instead last forever. In other words, that they were now completely disinherited by God, left, and they're essentially not people of God anymore in any way, shape, or form. Okay, you had Cyprian saying that the Jews had been replaced by the Christians and should all be expelled from his diocese at the point of the sword. So, in general, during the patristic period, in the patristic literature, there's nearly an absolute condemnation of the Jews. And, again, it starts this early. Okay, it starts this early. It starts even in the patristic era, where you're getting very anti-Semitic language coming from some of these early patristic fathers, who wrote very good things in a number of different cases, but were almost all very anti-Jewish. And so we have to kind of see it from this light that this started very early. It started from hostilities between the Jews and the Christians in the very beginning, right? When the church was very young and Israel still persecuting the church. That then shifted as Israel was destroyed and as the Gentile church became to dominate. Along with some of these Jewish heresies that were coming in, the Gentile church essentially asserted its authority and really started speaking negatively about the Jewish people, unfortunately. Now, what happens as we proceed into the Constantinian era? Well, this is going to intensify. This anti-Judaism is going to intensify up and through the 4th century. So at this point, people are saying things like, Jews are monsters. They're a theological abstraction. They have superhuman cunning and malice, and more than superhuman blindness. Okay, so you can probably tell where people are getting this from. Okay, the verses in Scripture even that talk about the Pharisees, you know, trying to be cunning or trying to be you know, trying to do their thing, or their hearts are full of hatred, right? And it's like, well, that's talking about the Jewish leadership, which hated Jesus, not Jews in general. Okay, the superhuman blindness thing. Oh, see, they were blind, but now we have our eyes opened. So you get a lot of this kind of language. And I just want to point out, when you use this kind of language, and in light of some recent events in modern day, when you use language like that, you say, oh, the Jew is now a monster. Okay, when you make a comment like that, when you say something like that, you're saying that a human being is sub a human being, right? When you actually study genocides, the first thing you have to do in the mind of a people to get them to accept a genocide is essentially denigrate a person, people, group, etc. so much that they're no longer viewed as real human beings, that they no longer have the dignity and worth due an image bearer of God. You have to do that first. And so we can even see in the first couple hundred years how that type of language is becoming the common language of theology. And it's very sad, actually. It's very sad that's the case. Origen was saying, and again, he had the allegorical approach that the church is the new Israel. And he also supported the union of the empire and the church. Constantine made it a crime to convert to Judaism. There was a military attacks against the synagogue as well. And out of this era, you have the people who are known as the four pillars of anti-Judaism. Again, some who did phenomenal things and amazing works in other areas. But in the area of Judaism, they really got it wrong in Jewish people, Jewish Christians even. So first we start with Ambrose. So Ambrose said that the Jewish synagogue was a house of impiety, a receptacle of folly, which God himself had condemned. And he orchestrated and praised the burnings of synagogues. Okay, Jerome, who translated scriptural Latin Vulgate, a great accomplishment, had much contempt for Jewish Judeo-Christians as the Jews did themselves. Interestingly enough, even Jewish Christians were not okay. And he said there was not a place for Jews. He argued they were crude and carnal and lewd and materialistic. Materialistic, that's going to come in a lot, right? Their success means they're materialistic. Okay, Chrysostom, in his homilies, wrote against the Jews. He really hated and slandered the Jews. And this was one of the deepest sources of modern and prevailing anti-Judaism, was actually Chrysostom's work. Augustine did take a more temperate view, but he still had an anti-Jewish legacy that we have to deal with. And he argued the Jews were a wandering, homeless, rejected, and accursed race, that they were incurably carnal, that they were blind to spiritual truth, perfidious, faithless, and apostate. I mean, my goodness, this is brutal. And he said that their crime was one of the cosmic proportions, and that merited the exile and subordination to Christianity, and he even argued that Israel was being made to serve Christianity. And out of Augustine, you're going to find a allow them to exist, but exist as exiles. In other words, never a homeland, never a land of their own. They're allowed to exist, but they're not allowed. They're allowed to survive, but not thrive. That's another good way to put it, to sort of explain Augustine's thinking. And so, again, and I'm going to kind of do this a couple times, just take a look at the first couple hundred years here, first 400 years. The anti-Semitism is rampant, and it is strong. It is unbelievably strong. To a people group, and I want to say this again, that virtually had zero power at that point. They had no nation, no king, nothing. They were dispersed. They were conquered. And yet, to that conquered people, just heap the insults and heap the negative statement. I mean, just keep heaping this stuff on over and over again. But that's what they did. So what about church councils? Well, there's the Council of Elvira in Spain, and this banned all community contact between Spanish Christians and the evil Hebrews, and it prohibited marriage except for the Jew was willing to convert. And the Council of Nicaea continued to dissociate Christianity from Judaism and stated that Easter would no longer be celebrated during the Passover, an attempt to, again, remove this from the Passover. Okay? So, there's a lot of anti-Semitism even in the first couple hundred years. Now, what about as we move into the 5th century, into the medieval period? So, the overall attitude of Christendom was even more hardened against the Jews. So, we have the Old Catholic early period first, 5th century, and the Bishop of Rome had essentially primacy over an established imperial church at that point, right? You have the official Church of Rome. And the civil rulership was moved to Constantinople, whereas Rome was the religious leadership. And you go from Augustine to Pope Gregory the Great, and then to Thomas Aquinas. You kind of see a thread there. And as far as Gregory, he forbid the forced conversion of Jews, which is good, but he very much was okay with Augustine's tolerance, requiring some form of subjection and misery. And there was a serious double-mindedness in his action. Now, the monastic middle period, you have people like Archbishop of Seville from 560 to 636, and he was zealous for the Jews converting, much like later Martin Luther would be, but he believed they didn't belong in a properly integrated Christian kingdom. So he very much is like, yes, you can convert, but you're still second-class sort of citizens. In Spain, oddly enough, under the Arab Moors, the Jews actually received better treatment for a time. Now, things continued to improve under Charlemagne, but the Archbishop of Lyon attacked Jews in a similar way to Chrysostom. Anselm had a love for humanity, which included Israel, but regarded them very much as pagans. And by the time you hit AD 1095, Pope Urban II initiates the First Crusade, and the eight campaigns concluded in 1270. And essentially, the treatment of the Jews was baptism or death in a lot of these. It's one of the negatives of the Crusades, was they offered baptism or death. In Mainz, there were several hundred Jews who were killed, followed by a service of thanksgiving, which is just ridiculous. And the capture of a synagogue in 1099 resulted in the burning of a synagogue filled with Jews. In other words, the Crusades were not pleasant toward the Jewish people yet again. I mean, again, you unleash an army that's meant to go and conquer the Holy Land and push back Islam, and essentially anyone who's not Christian is going to get mowed down on their path, which is very sad. It's what happened. Then you have Abelard of Paris, and he was, oddly enough, a lone defender of the Jews. He was the only leader in the Middle Ages who openly kind of attacked anti-Jewish traditions within Christianity. Bernard of Clairvaux was critical of killing Jews during the First Crusade, but characterized them as, quote, bestial descendants of the devil and murderers from the beginning of time. I mean, here's the thing. You can't call someone a bestial descendant of the devil and a murderer from the beginning and then also condemn killing them. Like, the person you're describing when you say a bestial descendant of the devil and murderer from the beginning is somebody who sounds like they should be put in prison and executed. I mean, that's the kind of language they're using. And so this type of double-mindedness is very common, and I would like to just point out that I do believe this is one of the enemy's ways of inciting violence and ways of doing these things, is by getting people to speak violently, which makes them more comfortable with being violent. And sometimes it's not even the person who's speaking the violence who's going to do the violence later on, but it's the people listening to it. So this is a common thing that you might see over and over again in human history, just in general, but especially toward the Jewish people. This is, by the way, a far cry from, you know, love them and love each other and you know, make them jealous. Far cry from Pauline theology on this. All right. Thomas Aquinas wrote from 1225 to 1274, and he essentially served as the major theological guy in terms of how people view Jewish people for about 700 years. And so he believed that a future salvation of the Jews would occur, but that what was going to happen is they were going to get saved in the future and then brought into the church and essentially dissolved and not be Jewish anymore. Okay? And it's at this point that the Catholic Church and the Christian state kind of reached their power, their height of power, and the Jewish people were going to be plunged into new depths of oppression and misery by this anti-Semitic hysteria. So we have the Fourth Lateran Council. Jews were forbidden to practice Jewish customs. They were forbidden to appear in public at Easter. They were barred from public office. They were required to wear a distinguishing badge. This actually started in the Catholic Church. They were required to wear a distinguishing badge. The council in Canterbury, England, Anglicanism, is going to affirm these same prohibitions. Now think about this. Where do you think in 1941 Nazi Germany got some of these ideas? Right here. Jews are forced to wear badges all the way back to the Fourth Lateran Council. So, you know, you start to see these things crop up. Nazism didn't just come, and especially hatred for the Jews and anti-Semitism, it didn't just come overnight. This had been building for 200 years. Now, what about the Renaissance late period? So these are the 300 years that precede the Reformation. And though there were many cultural advances, and again, I take that back, the Council of Canterbury in England, that was still Catholicism. That wasn't Anglican. England comes later. Sorry about that. Though there are many cultural advances, the Jewish people became increasingly oppressed through several movements. So monasticism, oddly enough, was not happy toward the Jews. There was a lot of zealotry. There was inquisitions of the Jews that included book burnings of things like the Talmud. There's mass expulsions of the Jews. Edward I confiscated Jewish assets and expelled them all in 1920. as an example of things like this. After 350 years, oh, in 1920, I might have had a misprint on it, sorry. Let me check one thing. I think I might have accidentally the wrong date there. I'll make sure my date's right. 1920 sounds very, very late. Sometimes that happens when I'm taking notes. All right, give me one second. Just want to do a quick double check. If I can find it, which I may not be able to. That's okay if I can't find it. Let's see here. Oh, sorry. 1290. 1290. That makes a lot more sense. Not 1920. 1290. That'd be hitting the one number before the other. Okay. After 350 years, they were able to return under Oliver Cromwell. Jews were expelled from France in 1306 and again in 1394. Jews became prosperous in Spain, but after the Inquisition, they were expelled in 1942. So you see Jewish people coming prosperous as the hand of God is on them, and then they're attacked for it. They met the same fate in Portugal as well. So in Norwich, England, in 1144, they charged the Jews with infanticide, using a slain child's blood to make matzos, or unleavened bread. Again, disgusting things. This is reminiscent of, you know, the accusations against Christians being cannibals for communion. It's like, why are people even saying these things? They're just lies, okay? They were also accused of three charges of wafer desecration or abuse of Christ as present in the offering of Mass. And essentially by 16th century, there was a pervasive and dominant anti-Jewish legacy throughout Britain and Europe. And it was only going to get worse. We then have the Reformation period. So we have Martin Luther, devoted Augustinian monk, and had blatant anti-Judaic tirades at the end of his life. His last sermon, he pleaded that all Jews should be expelled from Germany, and that ultimately, this as well as all of these other anti-Semitic things are just beyond defense. Like, how do you defend this? You just don't. Why was it allowed to happen? Well, again, people can say these things because of the general anti-Semitic attitude prevailing throughout the regions. John Calvin didn't harass the Jews, but did keep them out of Geneva and would often repeat and use anti-Jewish rhetoric. Spanish Moranos, or pigs, they were called. They forced to convert to Christianity by the Inquisition. They continued to be hounded even then. And wherever the Jews went, anti-Semitism was right there. In 1562, the Polish Diet or Assembly confirmed previous anti-Jewish legislation. The Jews were to dress differently from Christians. They were prohibited from owning Christian serfs or domestics and from holding public office yet again. However, the Reformation did provide an opportunity to thrive. And quote, in this new atmosphere, sophisticated Jews were welcomed on their merits, at least until the anti-Judaic reaction fermented again in Eastern Europe, end quote. So you do actually see Jewish people getting a leg up again and being prosperous again, but anti-Semitism always rears its ugly head. Now let's move into the 17th century Puritan period. So the influence of Protestantism did offer European Jews a greater esteem, but there was a brutal extermination of Jews by the Russian Cossacks when they refused to convert to the Orthodox faith. And this resulted in the flight of the refugees seeking safety in the West. And so eventually the immigration of the Jews to the West was allowed and to America as well. And this is where American Jewry was born, out of the Jews being attacked by the Cossacks. Now, Protestant reformers in the 17th century did try to tone down some of Luther's anti-Semitic rants, but again, there were still aspects that were there. However, you also have starting in the 18th century, or 1800s, you have starting pro-Jewish millenarian eschatology. You start to have this type of thing develop even in the 1850s, even in the 1700s, you still have some of these threads as well. The Puritans had a heartfelt interest in the salvation of the Jews, but it all too quickly dissolved into just simply wanting to see Judaism dissolve into Christianity. So you have that kind of as an issue as well. Now in the 18th century, evangelical period, so we now have the scientific awakening, and quote, the Jewish intelligentsia had been made to seem backwards and obscurantist. So this is where you get these weird caricatures of Jewish people as almost like apes. You get this a lot in here, the figures of contempt and derision, quote, dressed in funny clothes, imprisoned in ancient and ludicrous superstitions, as remote and isolated from modern society as one of the lost tribes, end quote. I mean, it really, you get this very strong, like, just depiction, anti-Jewish depictions and things. In 1740, the Russians wanted to either convert Jews or expel them. They forced baptisms and abductions from parents. Austria compelled the Jews to adopt German-sounding names, which were often insults. In 1791, the French National Assembly abrogated all anti-Jewish laws, and Louis XVI proclaimed full equality of the Jews. And so it allowed them individuality without nationality or territory. But with the defeat of Napoleon in 1815, the Jews were back under the grindstone again. And in Italy, they were actually forced to live in ghettos. So again, 100 years prefiguring what was done in Nazi Germany, they were forced to live in ghettos. Same thing in Frankfurt. And in Lübeck, they had total expulsion. So what I want you to see from this is the things that happened in, you know, the Weimar Republic and in Nazi Germany, the Third Reich, essentially all of this stuff was stuff that had been done before. It was now just being done again. So people were okay with seeing it. People often wonder, why didn't they see it? Why did they stop it? Why didn't they do it? Because they'd already seen Jews captured and put into ghettos. They'd already seen Jews expelled from territory. They'd already seen synagogues burned. They'd already seen all of these horrible. They'd already, you know, had in their history Jews having to wear special clothes. They'd already had in their history having to wear symbols. Like, this stuff was all present for the last couple hundred years. It was just the next step to literally liquidate the Jews in Germany. And that's essentially where it happened. And so when that started happening, it was just the final step in a long line of anti-Semitic behavior. And this is the reason why we have to simply stop with hateful speech, hateful behavior, things of this nature. If we want to argue with people, if we want to discuss with people, whatever we want to do, we've got to stop attacking people. Because when we attack people, we dehumanize them. And when we dehumanize people, we pave the way for this kind of stuff to take root. Now, in the 19th century, during the Gentile missionary period, the general trend is what? Well, at this point, the world's in a tough place. You've got social Darwinism, socialism, fascism, free market capitalism, liberal Christianity, deism, rationalism. You got all this stuff sort of competing for people's minds and ideas. And you are starting to see that post-millennialism is being replaced with an apocalyptic premillennialism. And this is going to be key in the establishment of the Jewish state in 1948. Now, support for the Jewish people and for land restoration is going to come in concert with this. But the Jews are still identified with high European culture. And I'll give you a quote from Voltaire here about the Jewish people, who said, "Our masters and our enemies, Jews are our masters and our enemies, whom we detest and are the most abominable people in the world." Again, make those kind of comments, what do you think is going to happen? Fichte wanted the expulsion of the Jews, and he said that was the only means of protecting the German nation. And Goethe and Feuerbach said the Jews are materialistic. Nietzsche said, quote, "The extinctions of many types of people is just as desirable as any form of reproduction," end quote. The guy literally called for genocide. And Wagner said, "I regard the Jewish race as born of pure, as the born enemy of pure humanity and everything that's noble in it." I mean, give me a break, but this is what they were saying. You wonder where this stuff comes from. This is why the rhetoric, it's like, no, you can't do this kind of stuff. Like, this will incite violence. Anti-Judaism now became intellectually respectable, right? These philosophers and things, they started to become anti-Jewish, and now it's just accepted. Pope Leo XII reestablished a Jewish ghetto and ordered forced conversion sermons on the Sabbath. Karl Marx said, quote, "Out of the entrails, bourgeoisie society continually creates Jews. Emancipation from huckstering and from money, and consequently from practical real Judaism, would be the self-emancipation of our era." I mean, scary stuff. He's calling for the execution of the Jewish people. I mean, they all are. So you wonder why this happened, and this is exactly why. And this is why, even nowadays, we talk about some of the rhetoric that's going on about the Jewish people. It's like, no, this just has to stop. It's got to stop, because the words have consequences, period. Words have consequences. So saying these kinds of things, arguing for people's death, literally arguing for their death, I mean, this is not okay. All right, then you have a commitment to eugenics as well. And so the comment was that Judaism must be removed. And this becomes the philosophical foundation of the Holocaust. And it occurred a generation before the Holocaust actually happened. And so you had the Christian Socialist Workers Party as an anti-Jewish foundation, as a central feature of Berlin. You had the Anti-Semitic League in France, which tried to order the expulsion of the Jews. And some came to the conclusion that the only solution for wandering Jews would be the establishment of a Jewish homeland, interestingly enough. again, feeding into some of that pro-Judaism that could happen, and leading to things with the Balfour Agreement and stuff like that. Now, the Jewish missionary period. So then you have the Weimar Republic and Nazi Germany in the early to mid-1900s. And what's important to see here is that 70% of the pastors in Germany had allied themselves with the anti-Judaic German National People's Party. And so, which, again, hostile anti-Judaism permeated the Protestant press, millions of readers, quote, Jews were the national enemies of the Christian national tradition, end quote. The Catholic Church essentially remained very thoroughly and publicly anti-Semitic throughout this whole thing. And the bottom line is you wonder why the church did nothing, because the church was promoting this. Let's be honest with ourselves. The church is promoting this. Now, Clark Williamson said this. I'm going to give two long quotes here to kind of cap off our talk on this. Clark Williamson said, concerning the anti-Semitism during World War II, quote, all the literature one reads on the final solution, and the final solution is the extermination of the Jews, leaves the clear impression that the pervasiveness of classical Christian anti-Jewish theology was a significant factor in the success of Hitler's program. Where it did not directly contribute to support for Hitler's policies, and it often did, it created an apathy toward Jews that was equally decisive in permitting the Holocaust. The majority of German people did not actively support or actively oppose Hitler. They were merely indifferent. In 2002, Melanie Phillips, Jewish columnist, said this, quote, openly confessed by Christians. So she was in a group where people openly confessed by Christians that the church's hostility had nothing to do with Israel's behavior toward the Palestinians. Interesting. This was merely an excuse. The real reason for the growing antipathy, according to Christians at the meeting, was the ancient hatred of Jews rooted deep in Christian theology and now on widespread display once again. A doctrine going back to the early church fathers, suppressed after the Holocaust, had been revived under the influence of the Middle East conflict. This doctrine is called replacement theology. In essence, it says that the Jews have been replaced by the Christians in God's favor, and so all God's promises to the Jews, including the land of Israel, have been inherited by Christianity. So, again, what I want you to see through all of this is you've got, at the very beginning, a sort of Jewish persecution of Christianity, but then quickly Gentiles begin to dominate, Israel falls, and then the anti-Semitism is essentially on parade for nearly 2,000 years uninterrupted, except for brief periods by certain people, and then again briefly in the 1900s, and to those who hold to a more dispensational persuasion even now. And the bottom line is, you know, I spoke on Israel promoting, you know, dispensationalism and pro-Israel theology recently, and I got a lot of hate yet again from people, missionaries and people who were decidedly anti-Israel. And so I see these things. I get hit with this stuff as well. Being pro-Israel puts you in the targets as well. And we continue to do it because we believe that Israel is still God's people, that God still has a plan for Israel. And we celebrate the Jewish people because they are the people of God. And so the bottom line is again, and this stuff does get me fired up a little bit because it's hard to read, it's hard to lecture on because it's just so awful, the anti-Semitism throughout this. If only we would all take Paul's comment of, be so loving, so kind, so gracious, so full of hope, so full of Jesus that they're driven to jealousy to come to Jesus. I mean, that really is the goal here, right? The goal is promote a theology that actually drives evangelism and salvation and doesn't shut it down. And so that's kind of what I wanted to end on today. Next week, we're going to be talking about contemporary examples of Christian anti-Judaism in the U.S. So join us for that. I'm going to go ahead and open a Zoom call here. For those who wish to discuss this further, I'd be more than happy to continue talking. Give me one second here. Okay, we're going to see if this invitation pasted properly. It did not. So we're going to zip this back. All right, we're just going to go over here for a second. All right, we get the Zoom call open. Copy invite link. All right, there we go. All right, there's the invite link. So please go ahead and join us for the Zoom for a little bit if you want to talk more about this anti-Semitism about church history. And on that note, I'm going to go ahead and end. Thank you so much for joining us here at Spirit of Truth Church for this talk on Christianity and anti-Semitism throughout church history. I look forward to seeing you again next time, and I hope you have a wonderful evening.